We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. Thank you for tuning in to this exciting episode. I'm Alexandra, and today we will be speaking with an inspiring guest, Michelle Yu. Michelle has not only embarked on an incredible journey through the world of startups, but has also made a significant impact in the realm of climate change mitigation. Michelle takes us on a fascinating journey through her life's transitions, a professional evolution from her early passion for English literature to her pivotal role in the creation of Songkick, a groundbreaking music platform. As we explore the genesis of Songkick and the power of technology to solve real-world problems, listeners can discover how Michelle's experiences, determination, and fearless approach to learning have empowered her to tackle some of the world's most pressing issues.
Michelle, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
You got an undergrad and master's degrees in English. Was writing always your passion?
I think reading is more accurate to say was my passion. I love reading literature. It's still kind of a hobby of mine to read fiction. And yeah, I just love stories and storytelling and interesting characters. So that's always been the case since I was a kid.
How did the idea for Songkick come about?
Good question. So I at the time, I really loved going to shows. I loved going to see live music. I would say my history with technology, I grew up in the Valley and my parents, you know, worked in tech. I always saw it as a tool to solve problems. And I loved how tech enabled you to have, you know, a better life. And so when my co-founders were, you know, deciding to quit their jobs, wanting to start a business, they decided to apply to YC. And when they were applying, we were discussing things around music because we were all big music fans. And I said, can you just make this thing that would solve my problem, which is that I'm scouring loads of Ticketmaster emails, venue listings, MySpace pages. This is back in the day when MySpace was still big. And I find it really hard to know when concerts are happening. I wish something would just go through my iTunes library, pick out my favorite bands and email me and notify me so I don't miss out. And that was really solving a personal problem, but it turned out as a problem that loads of music fans had.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting transition. I'm curious to dissect a little bit here. Like, you went from being magazine editor to chief product officer of a company raising over $60 million. How did you know you wanted to make such a big shift? And how difficult was that transition, given that you didn't come from a technical background?
Yeah, really great question. I wouldn't say that shift was like a planned thing. I've never been the kind of person who has a five-year plan and knows what my career trajectory is going to be. I worked in magazines because I love writing and reading, and I loved, you know, it was a culture, arts and culture magazine. So I really loved that job. But my co-founders applied to YC while I was there, and I was helping out nights and weekends, designing the product. And the more involved I got with Songkick, the more I just felt like I couldn't let it go. You know, we were having impact, we were signing up customers, we were raising from investors. So I kind of fell into it. And in the early days, I didn't have a title. I kind of did everything, as you do with when you're just three people. And I fell into the product role because I just loved building and designing the product for the users. And everything I knew, I had to learn on the job, which was incredibly challenging. But I think that's probably the one amazing learning I had through starting Songkick, is that I love the feeling of being pushed outside of my comfort zone and learning a new field. And I've learned through Songkick and our success there that anyone can do that if they just put their mind to it. There's no secret skill that's inaccessible to you. You can just figure it out. And I really took that same approach with Supercritical. You know, when I knew I wanted to focus on climate change, the only experience I had was I built an app that 20 million people use. Like, what the hell do I know about climate science, physics, nothing, right? But I tried to figure out like what problem is interesting to me, what aspect of climate change is something that I think is really, really, really important that I am obsessed with, and then how can I leverage my skills to help with that? And I wasn't intimidated by that challenge. I was okay learning from the start, starting from first principles, not knowing anything, and I felt comfortable with that process.
Yeah, that's super cool to hear. I feel that people get the sense that they are getting pigeonholed earlier and earlier in their careers, and even a couple years out of school, it's sort of this path that you're going down. And I guess startups sounds like a realm for people to be able to own, you know, multiple roles, wear multiple hats, and things they actually haven't even done before, like you just said. So going off of that, you led a startup for almost a decade, wearing a bunch of different hats, and I'm sure produced its fair share of stories. What's the coolest story and the worst story you have from your time with Songkick?
I think the coolest story definitely has to be ticketing Adele's world tour back in 2015. You know, she is probably the most popular touring artist of our generation, and she hadn't been on tour for like 5 years. And going to the O2, which is like the biggest arena in London, and looking around the room and knowing that half of the people who got there bought a ticket through our app was just, that's an incredibly gratifying experience. But I think that was probably the coolest experience. The worst experience, I think, as a product leader, making the wrong product decision. So building something, spending a lot of time investing in something that didn't end up working, like that's really, really painful. We tried to build a crowdfunding tool called Detour, where we allowed people who lived in kind of non-major touring cities to pledge to buy a ticket, and then we would bring them to their towns. We brought, you know, a band to South America for the first time, that sort of thing. And while it had a little bit of traction, it wasn't ultimately successful, and we had to shut it down. And that's really, really painful. But I think when I think about Supercritical, having gone through that for 10 years, I just know that that failure is part of the journey, and I have to be a bit more resilient and thicker skinned about it, rather than let it really disrupt your momentum and drive. So you just learn that it's like part of the journey is failing, right?
Yeah.
Diving deep into Supercritical, I'm curious to know what, amongst many ideas or many fields you could dive into, what led you to shift towards climate change mitigation in particular?
Yeah, that was a very personal shift, I think. So after leaving Songkick, I backpacked around the world for a year with my husband, and we just like cut off ties. We lived out of a backpack, and we did loads of outdoor sports. So we climbed and surfed and hiked and lived out of a camper van. And I read Yvonne Chouinard, the Patagonia CEO's memoir called Let My People Go Surfing. And I really read it because I thought they were an incredible brand and I love the outdoors. But the whole book is about the urgency of climate change. And I think that I describe that as my climate red pill moment. Like, I obviously knew climate change was happening. I grew up in California, you know, I recycled, but I didn't know how bad it was. And that was really the moment that it became very clear to me. And after you see that, you're kind of like, you can't think about anything else. And so at that moment, I decided, okay, I need to do something about this, but I had no idea what I can do. So I joined a fund here in London, a venture fund called Local Globe as a venture partner, just as a platform to invest in climate tech, but also learn about climate change and meet loads of smart people. And I just really had to take the time. It took me 2 years to arrive at the idea of Supercritical, because, you know, climate is everything from nuclear to clean meat. And how am I going to know? You know, I looked at things like algae farming and biochar and circular economy, like fashion stuff. And I really didn't know what it was, but it was when there were a couple of factors. It was when the founder of the fund, Saul, tasked me with getting them to net zero. He said, you need to get us to net zero. All our LPs are asking us these questions, endowments like Harvard, you know, asking us how we're going to get to net zero. Go figure this out. And I found that process of running that project incredibly frustrating. I spoke to loads of consultants and carbon accounting companies, and I just didn't feel like anyone was going to give me this end-to-end solution of getting to net zero, which is really simple. It's measure your emissions, reduce them, remove the remainder, right, with carbon removal. And around that time was when Stripe, Microsoft, and Shopify made their first carbon removal purchases. So I don't know how much you guys know about carbon removal, but it's this, you know, early stage technology. The best example is probably direct air capture, which is a stack of fans that absorbs carbon dioxide. It's any technology that will absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sequester it for long-term storage. And the macro climate reason why we need this is that in order to get to net zero emissions, you have to you remove an equivalent amount of what you emit, right? And we've now left it so long that all the scientists who model the climate, the UN body of scientists, the IPCC, they've now modeled out that we need to remove 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide annually by 2050. And these technologies have only removed like a few thousand tons. So we have this urgent scaling challenge. If we want to stay below 1.5 degrees as a planet and survive as a species, we need to scale these technologies. And no one was really focusing on that bit of the net zero journey. Everyone's thinking about removing, reducing, measuring. That's great, but we also need to remove. And the core mission of Supercritical is to help these carbon removal technologies scale. And we do that by working with companies who've made a net zero commitment, who have the ambition to buy these expensive technologies today, to send that demand signal and get them to the billion ton scale we need them to get to in a decade's time.
I appreciate that you mentioned the complexity of the problem, because I worked for an energy retailer doing like precisely that. So like working on sustainable product offerings for clients, and also this summer an energy merchant that basically trades commodities. And the renewable, I would say, question is super interesting. There is a lot of uncertainty, and that's why I believe there is a lot of opportunity for Supercritical. At the same time, we have seen an explosion in carbon accounting tech in the past couple of years. And so I wonder, how does Supercritical differentiate itself in this young yet saturated market, especially in terms of like, how do you plan to uniformly and standardize the way carbon is counted or measured?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that carbon accounting is seeing so many startups launch around the space. It's because it's the first obvious software solution to climate change, right? Carbon accounting is just basically a calculator and a spreadsheet in a UI form. We don't see carbon accounting as our main product or service. What we see as our main service is the carbon removal marketplace we've built. So we have a climate team that goes out and vets all these early stage providers. You know, we sell the same removal that Microsoft and Shopify have bought, but we make them accessible to the average 500 to 1,000 person tech company. That's our core customer base. And the carbon accounting that we do is really because that's required to get them to the point of knowing how much to offset, right? So we see it as an enablement tool, almost a calculator to get them to the point of checkout to buy what they need to buy. And it's not what we think is the most important aspect of our business. It's a necessary stepping stone into the marketplace, but the most important thing we care about is getting people to buy carbon removal and getting the best kind of supply base we can, getting them, you know, liquidity in our marketplace. In terms of measuring and accuracy, like I think that there right now the world is so early in greenhouse gas emissions accounting that it really varies. There's a lot of assumptions, a lot of estimates. Unless you're kind of holding a tool at the end of a tailpipe, you can't really accurately measure. You're guessing, right? Or you're estimating. And for a sector like tech, that's pretty okay. I think for other heavy emitting industries, you need more accuracy because you're going to actually use that data to do a lot more. We take a very 80-20 approach. For us, we would rather get an 80-20 accurate measurement, but get more people measuring than to let perfect be the enemy of good and take years to measure and get a precise to the decimal point number. And for our customers, directionally knowing of all of their emissions, what are your biggest sources? What changes should you make to reduce? That's the most important thing rather than getting the absolute tonnage exactly accurate.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, and especially because timing perhaps is the most important part of the equation.
Yeah.
Going off of this, like, what is your estimate for the percentage of net zero carbon emission commitments that will be met in time?
Oh man,
that's a hard question, but interesting to hear your take on this.
Yeah, I just read an academic study actually of net zero, analyzing corporate net zero commitments, and I'm not going to remember the stats off the top of my head, but there are a few hallmarks of a good net zero commitment. One of them is setting a near term target, right? So most of them say, "I'm going to get to net zero by 2050." It's like, that's great. You're not going to be alive or the leader of that company, so you're kind of punting it to somebody else. Having near-term targets of like in the next 5 years, how much are you going to reduce? That's kind of an indicator of a quality net zero commitment. And I don't remember the number, but there's something definitely less than half of the net zero pledges had that near-term target setting, which tells you, okay, if you don't know what you're going to do next year, how are you going to get there in 10 years, right? So I think the world is figuring it out, though. You have to really remember that the concept of net zero came about from the 2018 IPCC report. So it's only 4 years old. The 2018 IPCC report was the first one that very clearly said, in order to stay below 2 degrees of warming, we have to hit net zero emissions by 2050. And after that, that's when the UK became the first country to sign it into law. So as a concept, it's fairly new, and we're evolving how to do it and how to make better claims, how to kind of what a good commitment looks like. And hopefully it'll improve over time. But right now it's a very far away, vague goal in decades time, which means that you haven't broken down the problem and figuring out the steps you need to take to get there. So I wouldn't ask, I don't know if I could estimate a percentage of commitments that would make it there, but not very high right now.
That's very interesting to hear. And perhaps hopefully it's gonna go up over time. But right now, at the same time, like the global energy supply, I would say, is kind of like in a weird state because of the war in Ukraine and the lack of supply of natural gas to Europe and the UK, and also the fact that OPEC recently chose to like limit oil production. Like all those maneuvers are going to have deep impact in the price of energy. And so I was wondering, how do you think the current global energy situation is going to affect carbon footprint? And do you think that because of the energy crisis in Europe and also in the UK, less companies will be willing to improve their carbon footprint?
I definitely think the macro, you know, circumstances in our world right now challenge people prioritizing climate. In terms of energy, like I'm not an energy expert by any means, but I do know that what we've seen in Russia has forced the conversation within countries of how do we become energy independent. And the obvious answer to that is through renewables. So hopefully that's kind of accelerated the transition to renewables. I don't know, but that's, you know, that's my guess. But the thing is that the climate's not going away as a problem. It's just getting worse the longer we delay it. And we cannot allow wars or political issues or economic circumstances to let us distract ourselves, because it's only going to get more expensive and worse the later we leave it. And we ran a survey here in the UK around, like, we polled employees, like, how many of you, how much does this matter to you? How does your company think about net zero at a time of crisis? And something like 35% of employees would consider leaving their company if they didn't have a net zero stance and didn't have a strong sustainability policy. And when you go to younger employees, Gen Z, 18 to 24, that's more than 50%. So people care about this. Your teams care, your customers care. You really can't ignore this issue because it's just getting worse and worse the later we leave it.
It's great to see that, especially within young generation, there is a lot of interest and sensibility towards the topic. At the end of the day, we also are students. So we wanted to ask you a question that's more related to college and the experience that perhaps people our age can have with startups. And so like, we wanted to ask you, what would you do if you were a college student today? And would you, specifically, would you go straight into startups, or would you acquire some experience first and then create a startup in a field?
I don't think there's one right answer to that question. As in, like, would you go straight into founding a company versus work somewhere else for experience? I think that's just such a deeply personal question about what you feel ready for, your personality type, kind of what makes you feel confident in starting a company. So yeah, I wouldn't try to give a one-size-fits-all answer to people. I think what I would say, because startups wasn't a path when I graduated from university, you know, we were maybe the third cohort in Y Combinator. It just wasn't like an obvious career path. And I think what served me and my founder as well is just we followed our interests. Like we really enabled ourselves to think, you know, follow what we're really passionate about and what kind of drove us to work hard. And we really didn't compromise on that. And so I think that especially high achieving people like yourselves going to Ivy League University, you think that there's this like list of things you need to tick off before you're like a good high achieving person. And that's not how life works, right? So I would say just really interrogate, rather than what you think everyone else is telling you what you should do, your parents, your teachers, whatever, like, what do you care about? What's interesting to you? And if you have an inner drive and you follow that, you'll kind of go as far as you want to go.
Knowing what you know now, can I push you a little bit on what you would have done personally if you were a college student right now?
Yeah, I don't know that I would do anything differently, because I loved literature and I just loved to read, and I didn't really question the utility of that degree. You know, my parents definitely questioned it. They're like, "Why the hell are you studying English? You should go into law." But I can't force myself to be interested in something I'm not interested in. I think that straight after college, I worked at Random House, a publishing company. And that was a really, you know, it's a corporate experience, but it was in publishing and dealing with books, which was great. But I think what was really shocking to me when I graduated, and I think you guys are way more sophisticated than I was back when I was you know, 18, 19, you spend your whole life going to school, and kind of what you have to do is set out for you. You go to elementary school, junior high school, graduate from high school, apply to college, go to college, get, you know, valedictorian, whatever. But the minute you graduate from university, there's just no set path. You kind of have to figure out on your own. And I remember that summer and going to work, I was like, I felt so lost. It's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing now. Like, I have this job. Is this the right job? Should I have a different job? Should I go to grad school? And I was totally unprepared for that freedom of choice. And I think if I could go back, I would have thought a little bit more about that, like post-graduation, when there's no like treadmill of more school to do, what do I want to do? I felt like I hadn't asked myself that question. So that's what I would change. But other than that, I wouldn't change my college experience.
I would say that being a founder definitely gives you a framework to navigate all this uncertainty. And so when specifically you're looking for a team member, perhaps a co-founder or someone to work with and build a product, what do you look for?
I would say for the early stage employees we've hired, we have a very specific set of questions we interview against. And a lot of it is around, well, I mean, there's just like the basics of like, are they smart? Can they do their job? Do they have the skills qualified? But there's, for me, I really look for integrity and kind of an honesty about themselves. So asking questions around like, how self-aware are you? How much can you interrogate and introspect around what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong, how you can improve? And like, without that, I think you're just not going to be a great colleague, right? Unless you have that humility and that introspection, and you're not going to be able to improve and you won't take on feedback well. The other thing I specifically look for in early stage team members is just kind of like an independent streak that shows that they think about things for themselves and they're kind of willing to buck against trends to pursue their own path. And I think at a startup, when so many things are uncertain and there is no clear, you know, role definition that this is what you're going to be doing for the next year, you have to have like a drive to figure that out for yourself. And that I think is an attribute that we really look for in early stage employees.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing that I really love about doing this show is just being able to talk to people who have so much more life experience than myself.
Yeah.
And you've given a lot of good insight and a lot of great advice today. So our final question for all of our guests is always, what is your hottest take or most controversial opinion?
Oh, well, you know, so before I started Supercritical, I went on a deep dive on offsets and like what people were buying and what are offsets even? What is it? Like, what is it? And I think coming from the outside, never did not know, you know, I've seen it in the checkout when I buy an airplane ticket, but I never really understood like, what am I buying? And the more research I did, the more I was just shocked by the state of the offsets market. I was like, this stuff is really bad. Crap, it's not doing anything, it's full of fraud, but we're all buying it because it's like all we know what to do. I think the most telling one was I interviewed like 30 tech companies who bought offsets, and all of them said to me, oh, well, you know, like when my consultant gave me these offsets, I was like, oh my God, that's really cheap. That feels like sketchy. I'm just going to double my spend and buy twice as many because it's so cheap. And it's like the average offset is like $5 a ton. And if that was a real solution, why wouldn't we be spending money to solve this problem? Because it's so insanely cheap. And so I think the whole system of it is completely flawed. And it's based on this premise of paying someone else to stop emitting. So this is like the conventional offset on the market, it's emissions avoidance. So I emit a ton, I pay someone else to stop emitting by paying them to switch to renewable or paying them to switch to a clean cook stove. But the fact is my ton is out there polluting and warming the planet. Buying that offset has no bearing on what I've emitted, right? Like the two aren't connected at all. Whereas carbon removal, you're literally removing the same amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that you emitted. The responsibility and the accounting is very clear. And so I just think that the conventional offset, the emissions avoidance offset, while in principle might make sense, in practice it's completely broken. And I wish that people would stop buying them. I think they're just really full of shit and horrible. That's my hot take.
Makes sense to me.
No.
Really appreciate the time.
It's really great.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you are a company or an individual that is interested in working with us, please email us at hello@harvardventures.org. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @Harvard_Ventures. And be sure to tune in for another episode of The Bottom Line.